Hi, and welcome to this preview edition of the Two Off the First podcast. My name is Ryan Balogi. I'm your host. Thanks for subscribing to this show that didn't exist until you started listening to this very recording. I've been meaning to start this show for many months now and have had this idea in my mind and finally committed to doing it and told all of you, if you listen to the 19th Hole Golf Show, my regular podcast, my first podcast I've done for 17 years, that this was coming. And hundreds of you decided to subscribe to a podcast that didn't exist yet. And so I felt that, well, instead of waiting for a new podcast mic that I've ordered to come and start the show fresh, I would just do a preview episode to give you an idea of how this show is going to work. So the idea behind Two Off the First is pretty simple. It's a weekday show that's sized for the average person's commute, so somewhere from 15 to 25 minutes in length each weekday. And then around the special times of year where we have major championships or events like the Players Championship or the Ryder Cup or President's Cup, Solheim Cup, events like those, we'll do a show even on the weekends so you can listen and be caught up. But the idea behind the show is to be concise and clear and focus on two particular stories each day that are important to the sport, go in depth with them over that 15 to 25 minutes so you're caught up on the game and the news that you need to know without having to worry about all the clutter and the filter and anything else that you don't need to know or that you can find elsewhere through your Twitter feed or your Facebook account or Instagram. So this is kind of my view of what amounts to an audio newsletter each day. The most important things I'm reading about, I'm thinking about in terms of the professional game, the game that we play, that we call golf, or other issues within our sport. So the first topic today is a new protocol for equipment testing from the PGA Tour. They announced it in a letter to their players, which was obtained by multiple organizations and outlets. Golf Channel had it, Golf Week had it. They didn't publish the letter, but the gist of the letter is pretty simple. And it basically announces an expansion of their equipment testing policy. In 2014, the PGA Tour decided they would work with the USGA to come to random tournaments, and at random, they would test the equipment found in the tour vans, in the trucks that the original equipment manufacturers, the OEMs, bring to each tournament each week, and that they park on site, most cases, not always on site, but almost always on site, and that the USGA would come in with their equipment testing team, they would pick out equipment at random, these drivers, and they would conduct what's called a characteristic time test. Under the rules of golf, under the equipment standards by the USGA and the RNA, there's a limit the amount of time that a golf ball can be in contact with the driver face, and frankly, any face on any club. And the absolute max limit, including the measurement tolerance, is 257 microseconds, which is 257 millionths of a second. So the amount of time that your golf ball spends on the face of your club is incredibly minuscule. And that should tell you something about how we try to save shots, but I digress. The important thing here is that the USGA and the RNA have had this standard, and they've been testing this equipment at tour events on equipment in tour vans, but they haven't been testing equipment for the players themselves, the stuff that's actually in their bag and that they intend to play that week. And so during the Open Championship in July, the RNA, which has done this the last couple of years, decided to conduct characteristic time testing against player equipment that was in their bags and picked 30 players at random, told them to pick their drivers, send them over to the RNA testing folks. They would conduct the testing and then report back the results. And a number of drivers from several different manufacturers failed that testing, including one from Callaway Golf and one of their biggest players, Xander Schauffele. So Xander went public with the data that his driver had failed the test, in part because he thought the RNA had leaked the information to the public. So he wanted to get out in front of it, out of any potential allegation that he's a cheater or just breaking the rules. And so he explained what happened with his driver, and Callaway stood behind their product, of course, saying that everything that we make is legal. We don't make things past the legal limit, and that their testing indicated that the driver was within the conforming limits, but the measurement difference between the RNA's machine and their testing machine was different enough that it made it illegal in the RNA's eyes. So Xander couldn't use the driver. And what kind of came up as part of this whole thing is that there's something called CT creep, or at least that's what it's labeled by the folks at Callaway Golf, which is this idea that the manufacturers are making faces so thin and so technologically advanced at this point because they're trying to chase more and more distance, that they're at the point where they're so thin that even after as little as 30 strikes, 30 drives for a well-skilled player on the center of the face, that the material could kind of become compromised and become actually hotter than is legal. So it could become a little bit bouncier after a number of solid strikes, and therefore render it illegal pretty quickly. But players wouldn't know that, and players wouldn't be inclined to test that, because if it's legal when you get it, then you assume it remains legal as you play with it. And these guys go through equipment relatively frequently, but a driver is kind of a mainstay. Once you find one, you stick with one for a while. But little did they know, in relatively short order, that you could have an illegal driver. And so the PGA Tour has decided they're going to wade into this water a little bit more with the cooperation of the USGA. They're going to have them come to random tournaments unannounced during non-competition days, test players' equipment, and then tell them through a what amounts to a stoplight system if their equipment is legal or not. So if your equipment, if your driver is legal, and there's no reason to believe that it's going to structurally fail and become illegal anytime soon, you get a green light. If it is a conforming driver, but it could soon deform to the point that it becomes illegal, you get a yellow light. And if your driver is non-conforming, then you get a red light. And if your driver is non-conforming, then the driver isn't handed back to you, the player. It's handed back to your equipment manufacturer's representative. And now every OEM that has a driver being played on the PGA Tour will have to have an equipment manufacturer representative on site when these tests are conducted, so they can be the liaison between the manufacturer and player and the PGA Tour and the USGA. So they're going to be the middleman, so to speak. What's curious and what we don't know the facts of yet is how many drivers they're going to test, how much of a sample size they're going to do. What they do say in the letter to the players is that they're looking at basically the Darrell survey. And the Darrell survey is, strangely enough, a survey conducted every week where this company called Darrell comes out and asks players which clubs they're playing. And they then produce that list for public consumption. And that's why you get these commercials every week when Titleist says they're the number one ball in golf, and they tell you how many players chose them that week. That's from the Darrell survey. And when Callaway and TaylorMade brag about how many players are using their irons and drivers and things like that on tour, that's all part of the Darrell survey. And so the USGA and the PGA Tour have agreed they're going to work in concert with the representative Darrell survey to figure out how many different clubs to test from different manufacturers. So if you're someone that's kind of up and coming and for some reason you only have one or two or three players using your driver, it is extremely unlikely that you will be tested more than once in a season. But if you're a Callaway or a TaylorMade or a Titleist, which has some of the highest driver counts in golf, then they're more likely to be tested, and more players from their staff are more likely to be on the receiving end of a test. It'll be fascinating to see if the PGA Tour announces these results over time, even in an anonymized way, where they tell the public how many people have basically been playing with a non-conforming driver for the coming season, or whether they're just going to keep that all under wraps. Because as the PGA Tour does with their anti-doping program, they are not required to tell the public about suspensions. In fact, they can keep those, especially for drugs of abuse, which means in their mind, like marijuana and cocaine and things that are illegal and illicit, they don't have to tell the public about that. They can just avoid telling the public that. It's up to the player if they choose to tell the public. Now, for PEDs, they're required by policy to tell the public. But if for some reason someone has a substance abuse problem, they aren't required to tell people. And so I don't know how this will be worded, how this will be conducted, whether they have to tell the public if a player has a failing driver, or whether the word will get out about that, or how that's all going to work out. So there's a lot kind of left unknown so far about the driver testing. We just know that it's going to happen, and that it's ostensibly, at least, inspired by what happened at the Open Championship with Xander Schauffele and the other drivers that were considered non-conforming. And this is, I think, a good decision for the PGA Tour. They need to ensure that the field feels confident that everybody playing their equipment and playing on the PGA Tour is using equipment that is conforming, especially with how far drivers can go these days, how far players can hit them. The driver ball combination has kind of come under renewed scrutiny this year, particularly later in the season, because so many people like me who have long advocated for some kind of bifurcation of the rules or rollback of how far the golf ball goes, kind of realize that there's not going to be much done from an equipment perspective on the golf ball because it is a high margin product. It makes a lot of money for Titleist and others. And to all of a sudden create two different golf balls, well, that might make a big problem. It may be easier to actually manufacture smaller driver heads or shorter drivers to force players into using equipment that doesn't go quite as far. And I think we'll kind of get a sense of some pushback on that later in the year. But the idea is now for a lot of people in this rollback community that if you're not going to roll back the ball, roll back the driver head. Because that's really the one club that causes the most problems. If you look at irons, I mean, players are hitting irons a little bit longer, but the lofts are lower generally across the board. I mean, if you look at, take for example, a new Callaway set of irons, their Epic Forged irons, their 4-iron is 18 degrees in loft. The 2-iron that I carry in my bag, the hybrid 2-iron that I carry, is 18 degrees. So the jacking of lofts does a lot of contribution to the distance that we hear about on TV when you hear someone commentating, oh, well, he's hitting a 9-iron 170 yards. Well, he's also hitting what used to be a 7-iron 170 yards. So there's a little bit there to be wrestled with in terms of irons, but driver lofts aren't changing. The really only thing that's changing is the size of the driver head to an extent, the way it's shaped, and how hot the face is. So if you could just regulate that one club, the driver, then you might be able to accomplish a lot of the things that the PGA Tour isn't willing to do and that the USGA and the R&A are reluctant to do with the golf ball. It'd be interesting to see how that all kind of falls out. Today's second topic on Two Off the First is the Solheim Cup. The LPGA is off this week. They played the Cambia Portland Classic last week in the Portland area. Hannah Green stuck out and won her second tournament of the year, won her second career LPGA title, tracking down Yulimi No, who was an 18-year-old Monday qualifier who had a chance to earn LPGA membership. She had a pretty sizable lead going into the final round, and Hannah Green caught her and then beat her on the final hole to take the tournament away from her. And the interesting thing about that is, as a side note, the LPGA, unlike the PGA Tour, doesn't have a top 10 rule or even a top 25 rule like they have on the Korn Ferry Tour, where when those tours, if you finish in the top 10 or top 25 as a non-qualified or non-member, then you automatically get into the next event because that's your reward for finishing so high. And the idea that you finish high, people want to see you keep playing. So you're a marketable asset. And that's kind of the reward structure. Well, the LPGA doesn't have that. And they have some other rules that kind of make it difficult for a non-member to earn membership. Effectively, you have to win to get it, or you have to go through the Q school. There really isn't a non-member system that makes it easy, because if you get sponsor exemptions, that money doesn't count as official money. And if you're a non-member, you may not get many starts to begin with without those sponsor exemptions. So if you go the Monday qualifying route, that's great if you can continue to do that, but there's very little incentive to continue to do that, because if you finish like No did, second in the tournament, and you win a boatload of money, which is great, but you also don't get into the next tournament. You're back to Monday qualifying. It's kind of a deflating process all over again. So unfortunately for, you know, Let Me Know, she's now in a position where she's going to have to go try a Monday qualify for the few remaining events that have open qualifiers, as the LPGA is about to go on its Asian swing after this, which is the Solheim Cup. Solheim Cup is their biannual competition. It's every 2 years. It's on odd number of years. It's their version of the Ryder Cup. It pits 12 American women against 12 European women. This time is at Gleneagles in Scotland, which hosted the 2014 Ryder Cup, where the Europeans demolished the United States, and it wasn't even all that close. Remember, that was the Tom Watson Ryder Cup, where Phil Mickelson threw Tom Watson totally under the bus and then drove back and forth a few different times at the post Ryder Cup news conference that instituted the change that created the Ryder Cup committee, that created the kind of working group that would determine future captains. And that's how we got to where we are now, with having guys like Tiger Woods kind of be an assistant captain, then a captain, and build off of Fred Couples' success, and Davis Love coming back, and all of that kind of working together as a way moving forward. But that's never been a problem, really, for the Americans. They have dominated the Solheim Cup going back into the 1990s when it began. They have largely won out in the series, but there have been stretches where the Europeans have won either on home soil, but they've been rare to win on American soil. They won in Colorado Golf Club a number of years ago, 12 years ago now, and it was a shock to the system for the American side because it never happened. They were widely expected to win, and they got demolished, and it was kind of a big sobering moment for them. And since then, it's kind of gone back and forth a little bit, but with Julie Inkster at the helm, the Americans have won two in a row. They're going for three in a row with Inkster as the captain. Presumably, this is her swan song because there are other players that would like to lead the American team. And she brings a relatively inexperienced squad to Scotland to take on 12 European players that have more of a mixture of previous experience in the Solheim Cup and less rookies, ostensibly. The American side has a handful of rookies and a bunch of players who have competed in one Solheim Cup, and that was on American soil. So they don't have the sense of trying to play a road game, so to speak. And so with all of that as background information, the folks at Aberdeen Asset Management put together a news conference, a pair of news conferences, with UK journalists meeting with Julie Inkster, the American captain, and American journalists meeting with Katrina Matthew, the Scottish-born captain of the European side, just to talk, just to get a sense of where they are in the week or so leading up to this big event. It's one of the biggest events in women's golf. And it was really interesting to talk to Katrina Matthew. So it was myself, Randall Mell, Beth Ann Nichols, and Steve Eubanks, who were really, kind of reluctant to say this, the only four people who cover women's golf on the reg, which is disappointing. But nevertheless, we spoke with Katrina Matthew about a variety of subjects, and I wanted to get at two questions with her, and unfortunately they didn't record the audio of this, so I kind of have to relay what she meant by paraphrasing it. But the first question I asked her was about having a plan B. And when we talk about these types of events, captains will often say, you know, we're trying to figure out pairings, we're trying to work out who will work with one another and in what formats they'll work with one another, whether it's foursomes, four ball, who are you going to pair, when are you going to play them, how are you going to send them out. All of those types of things are kind of the things that you know going into it for Friday, the first day, whether that's Ryder Cup or Solheim Cup. But by the time you get to the end of the first session on the first day, things change and you kind of realize what you have to work with. You realize what the other side is doing and their strategy and how they're implementing it on the golf course. And then you have to respond in kind. So my question to Katrina Matthew was, okay, you're probably going to know plan A by the time you get to the first tee on Friday, but what's plan B? And what do you do if things go wrong? How do you respond? And she kind of laughed. I mean, she did laugh. And she said, well, you should probably talk to me on Saturday what plan B will be if I need to get to it. And she talked a bit about how her philosophy guides who she's going to pair over these team matches over the first 2 days. So you have 16 team matches. And it sounds more than anything like it's a personality pair. She wants players to compete alongside of each other if they like each other, if they know each other, if they're friendly. Not if necessarily if their games match up or, you know, in the alternate shot format, one person is a better driver and the other is a better putter type of deal. She wants people who like each other to play with each other. And in some cases, they may have a built-in system because there's European nationality. So you can have Swedish players, you can have French players, you can have British players. I mean, you've got four women from England as part of the team. So do you pair them together based on country, or do you just find friendships that work and that have been standing on the LPGA Tour or the LET, or even go back farther than that into collegiate golf or junior golf, and do you work with that? And that seems where she's willing to go with it. And then if she has to kind of make sudden changes, then she will. But it's Saturday, and her mind is a little bit more up for grabs. She'll have to see where her players are, where the score is, and then she can make some decisions, but that she seems to have pretty well figured out a number of teams that will probably work, and if you get a couple of those, then you can have them be the staple of most sessions and filter in and out one or two teams that need to be changed or that may work for a particular format, foursomes or four ball, and go from there. The other question I put to her was about the pomp and circumstance of the Solheim Cup. Because this, I mean, and the same is true of the Ryder Cup and the President's Cup and the Walker Cup and the Curtis Cup and all these cups. There's opening ceremonies, you get all dressed up, you have this kind of thing in front of the public where you introduce yourself and your team, and you pair the matches initially. It's kind of a hype-building exercise. It's basically a golf nerd prom where you have this pep rally beforehand, and it works in reverse because all the formal wear is for the pep rally, and the actual golf is the game, so to speak. And I asked her, having been on a number of Solheim Cup teams and now being the captain, whether she feels as a player or feels that her players appreciate the pomp and circumstance that goes around the Solheim Cup and preparing for it versus do they just want to get down to it and play the matches. And of course you can't relay every player's experience, but Katrina Matthews said to me that she felt as a player she didn't appreciate what all went into making the Solheim Cup happen. Everything, every decision that had to be made, all the stuff that had to be done, all the boxes that had to be checked. And when she got to this stage of being the captain, and there are so many more decisions, and she makes so many of them, or at least has a big hand in making so many of them, that she now appreciates having a more personalized stamp on the day, on those opening ceremonies, on the closing ceremonies, all of that kind of stuff, how the stands look, what you're trying to encourage the fans to do on your side. It was interesting, and I've heard that previously from others, that sometimes you just don't quite know what all goes into it because you're not doing it. And then once you do it, you kind of think back and go, man, whoever was my captain for each of those events really had a lot to do, had a big job in front of them, and maybe appreciate that a little bit more. So it seems like she's in good spirits. It sounds like the weather forecast for the week is going to be a little chilly and a little rainy. Being that it's in Scotland, that seems like it's rather commonplace. So I don't think, and she doesn't think, that that's going to tamper down crowds or their interest in the event. Maybe they won't be as loud and noisy if they're trying to shiver or they're cold, but the crowd support seems to be pretty built in, and that they're going to do their best with what they can with the weather. Should be great. It's 5 hours ahead of the Eastern time zone, so you're going to have to tune in a little bit early to watch the Solheim Cup, but it's on Golf Channel. They do a great job covering it. It should be entertaining, and I'm really looking forward to watching it. Getting a little bit of a break from the PGA Tour these last couple weeks has been really nice. It'll resume next week with Greenbrier, but then you've got a really great little 1-2. You can watch Solheim Cup in the morning. You can watch, whether you want to watch football or golf or whatever sport you were engaged in the afternoon, and then have a really nice breakfast on Sunday to watch those 12 singles matches wrap up 5 hours ahead of schedule, and then be able to tune in for what you want for the rest of the day, including NFL Sunday. All right, that's going to do it for this preview edition of the Two Off the First podcast. We're going to do one more tomorrow since it's Friday, and we'll keep this thing going. I would love to hear your feedback. I have not done a new podcast, more than one episode of a new podcast, in 20 years, basically, since well before podcasts existed. And so I'm curious what you think of this concept. I think it's a good idea because there is so much going on in the world of golf, and so much of it doesn't get talked about, or it does in such a cursory manner that it's kind of a waste of time to even bring it up in the first place. So I'm hoping that by doing this show, by focusing on just a couple of topics each day, I can help kind of illuminate things in the game that maybe wouldn't otherwise come up, and share topics that I think are really special and really interesting, but maybe don't get a whole lot of play elsewhere. So feel free to hit me up on email, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. I'm on Twitter at Ryan Ballengee, RyanBallengee. And I'm happy to take your feedback. And if you like what you're hearing, please give us a 5-star review if you listen to us on your Apple device. It helps us reach more people, and it'll help us get out of the gate strong. So until tomorrow, I'm Ryan Ballengee saying thanks for listening to Two Off the First.